From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. New Hampshire is at an odd dual moment this week with the pandemic. As the first healthcare workers rolled up their sleeves for the coronavirus vaccine, the disease itself continues to target Granite Staters with rising infections, hospitalizations, and deaths. And there have been outbreaks in a couple of correctional facilities, including more than 100 inmates at the state prison testing positive. Today in The Exchange, our state's top epidemiologists are back to answer your questions. So listeners, send them in now on Facebook or by email to exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 800-892-6477. We're talking with Dr. Benjamin Chan. He's the state's epidemiologist, along with Dr. Elizabeth Talbot, the deputy epidemiologist and an infectious disease specialist at Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center. Well, welcome back, both of you. We always really appreciate your time. And before we get into a lot of the questions that we heard from listeners, I wanted to just get your sense of where we're at right now in this pandemic. And Dr. Talbot, you first. Vaccines are here. That's good news. But for many people, a vaccine may be months away. So how would you describe it, Dr. Talbot?
This is our first glimmer of hope here. I mean, I think that there's so much excitement among us who are in the trenches that this could be the way we turn this epidemic pandemic around. So we are very excited about the data we're seeing from the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine and also the Moderna vaccine. They are exceeding our expectations with regards to how well they seem to work and in balance have pretty acceptable side effects. So I think the prevailing mood here is that we may be on our way out of this, and that's just so exciting for us all.
And yet, Dr. Talbot, on the other side of that sort of split screen moment that we're in, a positivity rate for New Hampshire of 9%. That's pretty high. How do you sort of interpret that, Dr. Talbot?
We had had a low positivity rate. We were able to bring our positivity rate to less than 1% for quite a few months during this pandemic. The WHO recommends that jurisdictions try to stay below 5% because that reflects appropriate capture of those who are actually positive, making sure that we're bringing testing to everyone who needs it. So this rising number is quite concerning and indeed parallels the rising epidemiology we're seeing in our state. So we're watching that closely, as it sounds like you are as well, as a very negative sign in our epidemic control.
Dr. Chan, how about you? You know, what month are we in? 9, 10? I'm losing track. Not quite sure what day it is, really. But how are you feeling sort of at this dual moment?
Yeah, you know, I think there's two feelings going around. One is continue worry and concern at the numbers and the levels of community spread that we're seeing. And the other is, as Dr. Talbot mentioned, some hope now that we have a very effective vaccine. You know, when you look at the numbers of community transmission, it's not just the test positivity rate. By the way, that number is around 9%. So Dr. Talbot mentioned that ideally that should be less than 5%. We're now closer to 10%. You know, that indicates that the community spread of COVID-19 is happening faster than our ability to test and detect and contain the infection. And I think that's reflected in the other numbers. You know, over the last 2 weeks, we've had over 10,000 new people infected with COVID-19. The number of hospitalizations statewide is over 250 people currently, you know, hospitalized with COVID-19. So the community levels of transmission and impact are very high. But at the same time, we now have this new tool that is going to be very effective and very important in stopping this pandemic and preventing it from impacting people and communities the way it has.
Well, listeners sent us many, many questions about the vaccine. And throughout the pandemic, they've been asking about that. They've been sharing their questions about how the pandemic has affected their lives, their questions about vaccines and health impacts. And I want to let listeners know you can go to nhpr.org/coronavirus, where you'll find a survey to submit your questions or share your experiences. So you can go there. And Dr. Chan, Dr. Talbot, I want to share some of the most common questions that we got on our survey about the vaccine. And Dr. Talbot, to you first, lots of questions about the categories of people that the state has mapped out to determine when somebody can get vaccinated. So how is that determined?
We have convened a multidisciplinary group of persons who are experts in clinical issues, medical issues, operational issues, and we draw on several really important national sources for this kind of vetting of which populations should be in the first phases, right? So our goal in New Hampshire is primarily to reduce the severe morbidity and mortality, that is, reduce the number of people who are getting seriously ill and even dying from this infection, but also to reduce the negative societal impacts that we've all observed with this terrible pandemic. So the criteria for defining populations, it really centers on that, plus a very strong imperative for equity. That is, we recognize that there have been populations who have been continually disproportionately impacted by this epidemic, especially those who are in racial and ethnic minorities. So there are lots of features that have gone into defining populations, and we're right now in what is called the phase 1A or jumpstart phase, and many people are aware that that includes very intentional populations that I think most would find intuitive. That is, most at-risk health workers, that's clinicians, but it's also those who support care of patients who may not be clinicians. We also are paying attention to our epidemiology that tells us that those who are most likely to suffer the worst and die are those who are elderly, so especially in residential care, so our elders in long-term care facilities, skilled nursing facilities, and assisted living facilities are prioritized. And also first responders, because in New Hampshire, we've observed that, of course, our first responders, even if they're firefighters or police, are often first on scene for medical assistance. So they serve as healthcare workers in throughout most of our state. So that's where we are laser focused, to make sure that we are presenting the vaccine to those persons who are most at risk, both by virtue of their exposure to virus and also because of the negative impacts it would have on the patient population if they were to have virus and spread to their patients.
How does someone, Dr. Talbot, find out what category they might be in?
It's probably most clear right now as our first week of vaccine distribution. You know, it's incredible we're there. I just, you know, pause again to say,
yeah,
so grateful we're here right now. It's through the hospitals and those health workers who are at most and moderate risk for acquisition. So it's through employers, through occupational medicine there. The persons working and residing in long-term care facilities and like facilities are being reached in part by a federal program called the Pharmacy Partnership Program, the PPP, and also by our regional public health networks. So that seems well taken care of. Access is clearly defined right now. And in that last population, as mentioned, first responders, those are also through employers and in some cases through the facilities where they are grounded, if you will. So 1A, our jumpstart phase, what's happening right now is very well defined.
In the hospitals, people who work with in situations that would expose them to COVID-19 and also to the vulnerable elderly in long-term care facilities, Dr. Talbot, is that what you're saying?
Staff and residents, that's right.
Yeah. And Dr. Chan, I did read some concern that people who live in long-term care facilities, you know, who can't go to a hospital or a site some questions around how they might receive the vaccine and whether they might have to wait a little bit beyond this week and next.
Yeah, good question. And we, as Dr. Talbot mentioned, we have prioritized delivery and administration of the vaccine to those most vulnerable residents and the at-risk frontline healthcare workers in long-term care facilities. So they are prioritized to get the upfront doses of this limited vaccine that we're getting over the next few weeks. That is going to be administered in most nursing homes and long-term care facilities is going to be administered in the next couple of weeks through, as Dr. Talbot mentioned, the pharmacy partnership program, which is where the federal government sends the supply of vaccine that we have allocated directly to pharmacies like commercial pharmacies like Walgreens, CVS, Rite Aid, et cetera, to do the vaccination of the staff and the residents at long-term care facilities. That was a program that was set up a number of weeks ago that long-term care facilities have enrolled in. And so that is how the majority of our nursing home residents and staff are going to be vaccinated over the next 2-3 weeks, certainly by the end of December.
So is that set up yet? I mean, you can see the hospitals, they've got all the equipment in place and all the trained staff in place. But is that public-private partnership with CVS and Walgreens, where I'm guessing, Dr. Chan, people go out to the long-term care facilities and do the vaccinations on site? I mean, is that set up yet?
Yes. So this was something that the federal government set up with the pharmacies and the long-term care facilities enrolled in the program weeks ago. So that is actively getting up and running. The vaccine is being allocated to that program. And you're correct. My understanding is that the pharmacies will go out to the long-term care facilities to do the vaccination, certainly of the residents that are there who may not be able to leave the home.
And Dr. Talbot, a lot of listeners also want to know, do they need to register to get a vaccine, even if they are not in one of these early groups? And if so, how do they go about doing that?
I'm very gratified so many people are asking this question now. It suggests that we will stand up to this to protect ourselves and our community when it's available. But indeed, there's going to be an appointment-based system. So we've been patient for months, and we're asking for a few more days of patience to have those announcements go out. I understand that there's going to be redundant and multiple ways that people are going to be able to access this. So, for example, many providers, your own doctor, your own nurse practitioner, et cetera, are registering to be vaccinators. So some vaccine will be available routinely as you get other kind of vaccine. There are the fixed pharmacies that are likely to provide vaccine just as people get their, you know, zoster vaccine and their Tdaps and whatever. And then there's going to be these fixed state sites, just as there are fixed testing sites, there's going to be access to those who might not have primary care docs or otherwise. So, as said, there's going to be really multiple mechanisms that people can access this, and the registration, the appointments are going to be announced in the coming days and weeks.
Okay, so we'll wait for that. And I want to remind listeners that it's your chance right now to ask about vaccines and also just ask about where New Hampshire is with this pandemic. Even though there is good news about vaccines coming to this state, our guests are telling us that New Hampshire's community spread is quite concerning at 9% positivity in our test rates. Join us 1-800-892-6477. We're taking your questions by email as well, exchange@nhpr.org, or you can use Facebook if you like. Again, our email, exchange@nhpr.org. And both of you, Jerry's calling in from Freedom. Hi, Jerry, you're on the Exchange. Go ahead, please.
Yes. Hello.
Hi, Jerry.
Is Jerry Kinnerk. I'm Jerry Kinnerk. I'm state representative in the House of Representatives from Freedom. And what I'm calling about is, I'm sure that Dr. Chan and Dr. Talbot are both quite aware of the difficulties that we've had in the House of Representatives with the outbreak of COVID-19 following the Republican caucus, and then Representative Finch's death very soon after Organization Day, and then the deputy, Representative Rice, also having COVID-19. So the difficulty is that there's controversy about how we are supposed to go into meeting. A number of us have been pushing for remote sessions rather than meeting in person. And so the question is twofold. When Dr. Chan spoke 2 weeks ago, I think, on the program, he commented that for regular government meetings, if you don't have to be in person, you shouldn't. And I wonder if that applies to the legislature as well. And it should be being virtually. And the second is, because there may be difficulties with rules in terms of us having to organize our rules to meet remotely, could he suggest to the governor that perhaps there could be an executive order that would allow the House of Representatives to meet in session remotely to develop the rules going forward for remote and virtual meetings?
So, Representative, because you are an elected official, let me ask you, I mean, what are the rules saying now about, you know, you must have a certain number of people physically present to conduct business? I mean, are those the rules saying need to be changed? Because that's a political question.
We actually have to remember that when the Constitution was approved a couple hundred years ago, we didn't really know about COVID. And nor did we have Zoom.
Understood.
And the Supreme Court was asked for an opinion, and they weighed in saying that we could indeed have virtual sessions, that a quorum could be reached remotely. It did not have to be in person. But they also stipulated that we had to develop the rules for doing so. So the contention has been that perhaps you have to meet in person to develop those rules, which is why there are all kinds of bizarre things being thought of, including a drive-in session on January 6th, forced to elect a new speaker and develop the rules. But the question would be, since it's not written in the Constitution, how those rules have to be promulgated. I would presume it's something where an executive order could allow it. For example, we had committee meetings throughout the summer and fall.
Yeah, Representative Kirk, I'm going to let you go because I want to ask Dr. Chan your question. And I know, Dr. Chan, you can't address, you know, the constitutional questions, but you do give the governor and others advice on whether it's safe to gather or not. So I wonder what you think.
Yeah, so you're right. Lots of procedural and even legal questions there that we're not necessarily in a position to answer. But when we were asked this question a number of weeks ago, you know, I think the statement and the recommendations remain the same, not only for the legislature or the government or any government agency, businesses, for everybody, our recommendations remain the same, which is, you know, to avoid close contact, to avoid gatherings of people, especially in indoor, close confined spaces where we know this virus likes to spread. If people are going to be in person, they need to be separated by at least 6 feet, wearing masks, practicing good hand hygiene. You know, meeting outdoors is safer than meeting indoors. And, you know, we said a couple weeks ago, if people don't need to meet in person, that the safer option is to meet remotely. You know, those recommendations remain the same. You know, regarding the legislature in particular, we do have individuals that have been working very closely with the legislature. Dr. Bowler, the chief medical officer of the Department of Health and Human Services, has been working very closely with the legislature around trying to implement safety precautions to their meetings and to their procedures. But what is allowed and legal, you know, procedurally and through the law is a question that, you know, we can't really weigh in on here.
Well, lots more questions from listeners again about who's first in line, who's second in line. And Dr. Talbot, Maureen in Londonderry writes, is there information available on when and where the vaccine will be available to seniors who do not live in long-term care facilities? And Maureen, I'm glad you wrote because that's a question I had too. So go ahead, Dr. Talbot.
So the persons who have medical comorbidities that have shown, that is other illnesses that have shown to make someone very vulnerable to bad outcome from this virus, and those who are 65 and older are very much in our sights for the next phase of allocation. We are going to, in days to come, announce the mechanism that persons who meet these criteria can access vaccine, and that is through a multitude of ways. So, Dr. Chan, I think you wanted to add something to that.
Yeah, and I think as we've been discussing here, the focus right now is on making sure vaccine gets to hospitals and the frontline hospital healthcare workers and long-term care facility residents and staff. But absolutely, the next phase of vaccine rollout is going to need to target outpatient ambulatory care health workers, you know, which is a large group. It's not just, you know, doctors and nurses in private practices. It's, you know, dentists and home health workers and school nurses. There's a large group of frontline healthcare workers that work in an outpatient setting that we're going to need to target. And then also the vulnerable population, people in our population, you know, people that are maybe of an older age, have multiple medical problems that put them at higher risk, will absolutely be towards the front of the line to get the vaccine. So I think this is going to be a process, and we're asking for patience. We don't yet have a lot of information for when that rollout was going to happen in the public space and how exactly somebody can register. But what I can say is that we will absolutely be doing more messaging in the coming weeks around this. Likely many people in the outpatient setting will be funneled into or directed to go to some stand-up vaccination sites, much like we have set up testing sites, and that there will be a requirement to pre-register through an electronic system online before they come in so that we can do the appropriate, you know, questions and screening of people to make sure that, you know, they don't have any conditions that might need further follow-up. So more information to come, but it's going to be a process in the coming weeks.
Well, and my understanding is, Dr. Chan, that part of the reason the focus has been specifically on those elders in long-term care facilities is there's congregate living can increase the spread more rapidly. Is that why there's been that focus first?
So first, we want to protect our frontline healthcare workers, right? We need to maintain our healthcare system and hospitals, you know, make sure that they're operational, people can get care when they need care. And then the long-term care facilities, really, because the bulk of the deaths from COVID-19 in our state have been in long-term care facility residents. Huge outbreaks. We've seen huge outbreaks in long-term care facilities. You know, we're up, you know, over 600 people that have died from COVID-19 over the last 9 to 10 months during this pandemic. More than 80% of those people have been in long-term care facilities. And so we really need to protect those who are most vulnerable, which includes the residents of our long-term care facilities.
Yeah, and Dr. Talbot, I want to ask you about another congregate living setting, and that's prisons and jails. Massachusetts has said that incarcerated individuals will be among the first to receive vaccines. And as you both know, there have been outbreaks at New Hampshire State Prison, other outbreaks in Merrimack County and Stratford County facilities. Dr. Talbot, what do you think? Why is New Hampshire putting correctional facilities in phase two instead of in phase one, given the congregate nature of the way people live, and given that most people are living there for the long term?
Residents in corrections and staff will be in the next group of rollout. So it sounded from your question as though we were putting them farther down in the list, but it's a very dynamic process. I think that might be a way to couch this, is that this is really responsive to the epidemiology. So as you say, we are aware of cases transmitting within our corrections facilities, and therefore we've worked closely with Commissioner Hanks and the State Disaster Advisory Medical Advisory Committee and decided that those in corrections should be prioritized highly. Remember, the health workers, those in the clinics in the corrections will be in the very first phase. So we are already beginning to address the needs of corrections.
Okay. And when you say dynamic, that means following the epidemiology and how this disease is rolling out. Is that what that means, Dr. Talbot?
Yes. Thank you for helping me to say it a different way. I mean, absolutely. The dynamic, I mean, it's the vetting process, and it's the fact that we're getting information from lots of different sources. So taking that sip out of the fire hydrant of what's going on nationally, what's being advised by the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices and the Centers for Disease Control, and learning from the experience of other states and watching our own epidemiology change, that is how the disease is moving throughout the state. So we have to be nimble. So we are responsive to what we're hearing and what we're learning and what's going on. It was only on Sunday that we had information, for example, that it was going to be permissible to give vaccine to pregnant women. So I want to circle to that important issue. We know that pregnant women may be at higher risk of bad outcome from virus, and yet they had not been included in the vaccine trials. So we weren't sure where our advisory committees were going to land, but expert clinicians and those who are vaccine experts and are expert in the care of pregnant women have landed on the fact that this is a medically vulnerable group, and there is no reason to suspect they will have any increased side effects from the vaccine. So I'm very glad to be able to make that announcement. And so anyone who is pregnant or contemplating pregnancy should likely talk to their providers early about getting that vaccine when it's available in the next weeks to that population.
Well, I'm glad you answered that, because last week we did a whole show on vaccines, and that was a question that came in and we didn't have time to address it. So it's good to get that out there. We have to take a very quick break. When we come back, more of your questions about the vaccine. And then we'll be talking about testing capacity here in the state and hospitalizations, how our healthcare workers are managing as cases go up. All that's coming up, so stay with us. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, our state's top epidemiologists are here, Dr. Benjamin Chan and Dr. Elizabeth Talbot, and we have been looking at how New Hampshire's vaccine rollout will occur, also at the surge of coronavirus cases in the state right now. We're also answering a lot of your questions about COVID-19, about the vaccine. So email us at exchange@nhpr.org, use Facebook, or call 1-800-892-6477, and we'll try to get to as many of your questions as possible. Both of you, let's go right back to listeners. Diane's calling from Durham. Hi, Diane, you're on the air.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Go ahead, Diane.
Yes, I have a question about acute rehab.
You're very quiet, actually, Diane. Could you speak up, please?
Oh. I was wondering about acute rehab facilities, whether those would be included in the nursing home designated population that would receive the vaccine.
Yeah, and you're talking about patients in those facilities, Diane, as well as workers, I'm guessing, right?
Yes, exactly.
Okay. Thank you for calling in. And Dr. Talbot, I'll throw that to you.
So our hospitals are acute care, rehab hospitals, and also psychiatric hospitals that are first in this active rollout of vaccination to the at-risk health workers. Those persons living there will be taken on in a next phase based on their medical vulnerability and age. So the acute rehab facility, I think I've forgotten what the noun was for that from Diane, but
yeah, acute rehab facilities. Yeah.
Yeah. If it's a hospital, it's the health workers are being actively vaccinated. If it's akin to a long-term care facility that is dedicated to elderly residents, then they also are included. So again, I think you're hearing the intersection of medical vulnerability and also potential risk of transmission and care of those who are being asked to be on the front lines of this month after month after month.
And here's another question, Dr. Chan, that we got from listeners. And it's a pretty basic one, but it's so important. Is there going to be enough vaccine for everybody who wants to get it?
Yeah, it's a great question. And the plans, again, this is a process that is being directed and overseen by the federal government. And my understanding is that when the federal government made plans for developing and rolling out vaccine, that they made plans for, I believe, every person in the United States to be able to get the vaccine, keeping in mind that it's not just one dose of the vaccine, it's two doses of the vaccine. So we expect and hope that there will be enough vaccine to be able to offer it to everybody in New Hampshire that wants and should get the vaccine. I think the big question here is the timeline, right? And a lot of this depends on, you know, whether new vaccines are found to be effective and approved or authorized for use, what the timeline on that is. You know, are we going to have just two vaccines or three vaccines or four vaccines on the market? likely there will be other ones that will be approved, but the time frame for that remains unclear. But the goal and the plan is to be able to have enough vaccine to vaccinate everybody in the state.
You mentioned, Dr. Chan, the two-dose protocol for the Pfizer vaccine, and I'm not sure about the Moderna vaccine, but do you foresee any problems around that, Dr. Chan, this two-dose system?
So there are, right now we have one vaccine that has received FDA authorization for use. That's the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine. We'll just refer to it maybe as the Pfizer vaccine to save some verbiage. And then we expect the Moderna vaccine to receive authorization for use by the end of this week, and expect to have that vaccine rolling out by the beginning to middle of next week. So we're really looking at two vaccines, and they're both very similar vaccines in terms of how they create protection and how effective they are. Two vaccines that we are looking at rolling out here have rolled out this week, next week, and there are some logistical complexities with those. The Pfizer vaccine requires transportation and storage at a negative 60 to negative 80 degrees Celsius, ultra low cold storage temperature. And so that's part of the reason that this vaccine upfront is being distributed to locations that are able to manage that vaccine. You know, hospitals are able to manage the vaccines, you know, pharmacies are able to manage the vaccines. We have the capability of taking receipt and storing vaccines at that ultra low cold storage temperatures at the state. But that vaccine is going to present some difficulties for wider distribution to places like primary care practices when it becomes more available, but hopefully we will have other vaccines that are more stable at room temperature and able to be transported and delivered more easily.
Oh, that's interesting. So given the character of each vaccine, Dr. Chan, one might be more appropriate for one kind of setting and another might be more appropriate for another kind of setting. That sounds like that's what you're saying.
Absolutely. And the other point that I forgot to mention is that both of these vaccines, the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccines, are two-dose series. The Pfizer vaccine second dose is given 3 weeks after the first one, and the Moderna one we expect will be approved for there's a second dose 4 weeks after the first one. So we're dealing with different vaccines, different storage temperatures, different timelines between a first and second dose, and that adds additional complexity to how we roll this out.
Sure. And I did read this morning there's starting to be shortages of ice and glass because this Pfizer vaccine needs such low temperatures, and obviously it has to be kept in glass. Here's a question, Dr. Talbot, that lots of people have asked. Jerry in Holderness writes, I was wondering if people who have been vaccinated can still transmit the virus. And this is a big question, Dr. Talbot, as I'm sure you know.
I do know. I wondered if it would come up to us. It's a question I have as well. So the licensing trials for these vaccines used as their endpoint, they considered symptomatic confirmed disease. So they did not study whether people were protected against asymptomatic disease or that those could be protected against transmitting to their household and their contacts and et cetera. So we simply don't know. We will know in the coming months, but for now, it raises a very important mantra, if you will, that this vaccine will not turn around the pandemic on a dime, and we continue to encourage people to embrace all aspects of community mitigation, the social distancing, the mask use, the hand hygiene, and the et cetera. So it's such good news coming out in the vaccine arena, but it has to be tempered with the fact that indeed we do not know right now how well this will turn the need for those interventions around.
Yeah, so just to be crystal clear, Dr. Talbot, for example, there was an elderly gentleman who got vaccinated last week in Britain, and he said he was so happy because he was hoping to be able to spend some time with his grandkids over Christmas. So it sounds like what you're saying, Dr. Talbot, is if he does that, he still needs to perhaps wear a mask and socially distance because he doesn't know if he is carrying the virus and could give it to his family.
So here's our word again. It's dynamic. I'm expecting, we are all expecting that our public health leadership at the federal level will be observing what happens as the vaccine is rolled out in other jurisdictions like the UK, like Bahrain, like Canada, like the US, early adopters. And we're going to know something more about this in really the weeks to come. You know, really in short order, we're going to understand whether there is a advantage to taking the vaccine in terms of some of those interventions. Dr. Chan?
Yeah, I think it's also important for people to keep in mind that, remember, this is a two-dose series of a vaccine, the Pfizer vaccine. And it's been estimated that, and you know, again, not extensively studied, but the vaccine trial was able to estimate that they believe after one dose of the vaccine, they saw a approximately 50% reduction in symptomatic COVID-19, symptomatic disease. After two doses, they estimate the vaccine efficacy to be about 95%. So no vaccine is 100%. Even after two doses, there are going to be people that get COVID-19, get infected with COVID-19 after vaccination because the vaccine is not 100% effective. Certainly after only a single dose of the vaccine, it's going to reduce disease by maybe about 50% is what the estimate is. And that's why we encourage everybody to get the two-dose series or the series as recommended by the manufacturer and ACIP, which, you know, is two doses. But people continue to need to take precautions at this point in the pandemic, even if they're vaccinated.
Another question, Dr. Chan, we got from several listeners is, if someone has already had COVID, should they get vaccinated? And I know this may be another we're not sure yet question.
Well, so I think the answer to this is a little more definitive. Yes, if people have gotten COVID in the past, they should be vaccinated. The vaccine is still recommended for people who have been infected in the past. And the reason for this is because we know that a protection or immunity after a natural infection with the SARS-CoV-2 virus, the novel coronavirus, is not lifelong. We believe that there is some protection, at least for the first 90 days after somebody's infected, but we have seen reports of people being infected again a second time, even within those 90 days and after those 90 days. And so we believe the vaccine will offer additional protection for people that have been infected in the past.
Okay. Well, coming up, we will talk more about this. We will take more of your questions and comments, so keep them coming in. We'll also look at testing and how that's been rolling out in New Hampshire, some of the concerns there, and what we've learned about the health impacts of COVID-19, why they vary so widely. All that's coming up. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, our state's top epidemiologists are here, Dr. Benjamin Chan and Dr. Elizabeth Talbot, and we're looking at how New Hampshire's vaccine rollout might occur, also at the surge of coronavirus cases in the state right now. And we're answering your questions, too, about COVID-19, so email them in, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook if you'd like, or give us a call, 800-892-6477. And Dr. Talbot, one more question about vaccines, and I know we'll be talking about this in the future as well. What is your message, Dr. Talbot, to people who are concerned about how quickly these vaccines were developed and approved? Can you clarify that process for us, please, for those who might be hesitant?
Absolutely. I'm very glad you asked that question. I think what's helpful to know is that these vaccines have been subject to the same development rules, regulations, guidance as any other vaccine that's come to us. But because of Operation Warp Speed, they have been funded to produce the vaccine at the same time they were testing it. So really breaking a lot of records, yes, but the same processes for approvals. And really there will be unprecedented attention to monitoring for safety as it rolls out. You know, that we have some standing mechanisms that we always rely on, like our national VAERS system and MedWatch and others that clinicians are quite used to. But there's a novel approach this time around that I think people will be happy to know about, and that is the V-Safe system that CDC is asking everyone to participate in. It's a text message-based system that makes extremely regular inquiry to everyone who's received the vaccine for the purpose of attempting to detect any unlikely but early signals for safety. I'd like to talk a moment about what we know of safety to date from the trials, if you will.
Sure.
People should know what to expect, that there have been documented in the tens of thousands of people who have been studied, that there are side effects to be expected that generally overall reflect your immune system is taking up this challenge. That is, the local side effects, that is pain at the site where the injection happens, and the potential for feeling tired, having mild headache, some muscle soreness, this all reflects the vaccine is working. And these were seen in numbers that are familiar for other vaccines as well. So Dr. Chan, I think you want to say more about that too.
Yeah, I just wanted to echo and stress the fact that the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccines are very effective vaccines at stimulating the immune system and creating protection against COVID-19. And so what I think people can expect to hear and even experience themselves some side effects from the vaccine because of how good this vaccine is at stimulating the immune system. That should not be cause for alarm. That should not lead people to not get the vaccine or not get the second dose of the vaccine. So we just want to set the expectation that this is a very effective vaccine, but there are side effects that people likely will experience after the vaccine. Most of the time, these are mild symptoms. So local injection site, pain, swelling, redness, even swelling and tenderness in the armpit of the arm that was injected has been reported with some frequency. And then there are some systemic symptoms that people can experience, you know, feeling very tired, the headaches, muscle aches, even fever can occur after this vaccine. Those are all indications that the vaccine is effective and working, and it's not cause for alarm or concern if people hear about some of these symptoms. Most of the time, symptoms will occur within 1 to 2 days after the vaccine, and they will resolve on their own shortly thereafter. But certainly, if people are having more severe symptoms or longer-lasting symptoms after they get a vaccine, they should talk to their healthcare provider. But we believe this vaccine is safe. It's very effective, and we are encouraging everybody who it's offered to get vaccinated if they're able, because this is our way out of this pandemic.
Here's an email that came in from Pauline in Walpole, and she says, for Dr. Chan, on the same day last week that New Hampshire announced over 1,000 new cases of COVID-19, Vermont announced 80. Granted that New Hampshire has twice the population of Vermont, but their positivity rate is around 2%. While ours is around 8%, Pauline says, and you both said earlier, it's actually 9%. Pauline wants to know, Dr. Chan, why is our situation so much worse?
Yeah, so I think that most states around the nation are in the exact same position that we're in, Vermont included. If you look at their epi curve, so to speak, their epidemic curve, the number of infections on a daily basis, the trend is very similar to what New Hampshire is seeing, what Massachusetts is seeing, what Maine is seeing. It's hard to compare exact numbers state by state because states calculate these numbers in different ways. So I would have to go back, for example, to Vermont's numbers and look to see how they're calculating their test positivity rate, whether that includes just PCR tests, whether it includes PCR and antigen tests. The about 9% test positivity number that we've been quoting now includes both PCR and antigen-based tests. If you look at only PCR-based tests, that number tends to be a little bit lower. But when you factor in all the testing that is being done to detect infection in COVID-19, you get the number that we've been talking about, which is around 9%.
So are you saying, Dr. Chan, that the positivity rates around New England are pretty much the same, even though they look different?
Well, what I'm saying is that it's hard to compare some of these numbers state by state. You know, what I'm saying is that the community spread has increased in a similar fashion, between states and across states. And so we're really looking at this we're not just looking at one specific number like the test positivity rate. We're looking at the number of infections. We're looking at, you know, hospitalizations. We're looking at deaths, and those numbers are rising across New England, not just in New Hampshire.
I wanted to ask both of you about testing. And Dr. Talbot, to you first, what have we learned at this point in the pandemic about the benefits and limits of testing?
Benefits of testing are to know who might be potentially contagious, and therefore we can interrupt chains of transmission. That has been true from the beginning. We can't fight this thing blind. We need to know where the disease is circulating, where it's moving, and then react to it. So those benefits remain. We all had hoped for a perfect test. It has not come to us yet. So as mentioned, the PCR test is sensitive, but it can have a disadvantage of staying positive for even weeks following infection. So that can make it hard to take appropriate action if it's persistently positive. The antigen tests are less sensitive and less specific, meaning they are prone to both false negative results and false positive results. We believe there's a role for these. We want the right test in the right person at the right time, handled correctly, brought to the right lab under appropriate conditions, all of it. The entire cascade of testing needs to be attended to, and these are the, in your request, the disadvantages of these tests. They are imperfectly performing, but they do give us an extraordinary advantage over this virus for showing us where it's circulating and how we can protect communities.
And one concern, Dr. Talbot, for people who are told, you know, they might have been exposed, so they have to quarantine, or maybe they have to quarantine for another reason. One concern has been this long 2-week quarantine that's been advised. And, you know, a lot of people just can't do that if they need to provide for their family. So what's the role of testing in conjunction with quarantine to get people, you know, back and out in the workforce as soon as possible?
I think the very best role of testing during quarantine is early identification of disease. We've already talked, and people know by now, that this is a terrible virus for us, for the fact that it can be present in asymptomatic persons, and it can even spread from asymptomatic persons. So I think the best role of testing during quarantine is the early identification of infection. With regards to the use of testing out of quarantine, that is, getting a negative test and being able to get back to work, school, et cetera, this is something that we are not routinely recommending for persons, because the safest way for our state is to adhere to the recommended quarantine, which is now actually for most people 10 days. And I know Dr. Chan would like to talk more about that.
Yeah, 10 days is still a long time if you're an hourly worker and that's your paycheck.
You're right, and that's why there's been this change, and I think some other options that are going to try to reduce the societal impact of quarantine.
Oh wow, okay, go ahead, Dr. Chan.
Yeah, so I think it's important to keep in mind that there are different reasons why somebody might need to quarantine, right? Certainly, the highest risk of someone. The highest risk for coming down with COVID-19 after an exposure is when somebody is, you know, a close contact to somebody that's been identified with COVID-19. The highest risk for that is obviously in the household setting. And so we do not allow people to test out of quarantine in those situations. Now, we do recommend testing for people that have a known exposure to COVID-19. But as Dr. Talbot mentioned, the purpose of that testing is for early identification of infection, so that, you know, household members can be monitoring themselves. But people with a known exposure to COVID-19 need to complete their quarantine period, essentially, you know, staying at home, out of public places, you know, keeping away from others, even in the household setting. That quarantine period generally used to be 14 days, and based on CDC guidance and some options presented to states, we have elected to shorten that quarantine to 10 days, but people still need to complete 10 days of quarantine even if they're tested. And in fact, in certain circumstances, situations like in long-term care facilities, we're recommending that they maintain a 14-day quarantine as the most protective stance. But we felt that moving to a 10-day quarantine was both protective and helped to reduce the overall burden of quarantine on people. So still, 10 days is quite a long time, but better than 14 days.
We have an email from Robin about testing. Excuse me, not from Robin, from Bob. I apologize. Bob says, our son took a COVID test 2 weeks ago and has yet to receive results. How can he get them? Wow, Bob, 2 weeks is a long time. So, Dr. Chen, I know you can't specifically address when Bob's son might get it because you don't know where he got the test. Was it Convenient MD? Was it at one of the state sites? But 2 weeks is a very long time to wait for a COVID test. I wonder what the status of New Hampshire's testing system is right now. This is an ongoing issue.
Yeah, it's a great question. And we continue to hear these anecdotal reports of people with extremely long wait time for their test results. And that's absolutely frustrating and upsetting for the person and the family getting tested. And it's discouraging and frustrating for us as well to hear these reports. You know, based on the information and the data that we have, we believe that that's actually a minority. When we have looked at turnaround times from when someone is tested to when they get the results back, those were lengthening over the last, you know, couple of months as the number of people with COVID-19 increased, the number of people seeking testing, especially around the holidays, increased. But the numbers that we have are not anywhere close to 12-day turnaround time, right? So when you look at, our public health lab, the average time for turning around a test result is about 3 days. Even at some of the national reference labs like Quest, the average turnaround time is still about 3 days. So people who get tested generally can expect to get test results back within that time frame, 2, 3, 4 days, maybe 5 days. Obviously, the sooner we can get that the test result back, the better. But these reports of, 7, 10, 12-day turnaround times are, I think, uncommon and an exception, but still unfortunate for the people that are experiencing this.
Well, and for Bob's son, right, Dr. Chan, 2 weeks is basically a quarantine. So that's
right.
Enough of a test itself. If he hasn't, if he hasn't developed symptoms yet, he probably doesn't have it, right? I mean, that's a quarantine period.
Well, remember, you can be asymptomatically infected with this virus.
True.
So
yeah.
I think what I worry about with Bob is if his son indeed had disease, is it possible he's spreading within his household? Is Bob incubating disease? Should Bob be on quarantine? So, yeah, this is anecdotal to hear such a long time, and it makes me wonder whether the test result is lost as opposed to the test is still being done somewhere. But I think that there is resource at the state, and all positive results and negative results are reported to us. So it might be that you can call our state epidemiologist and help get that answer.
Oh, that's interesting. So Dr. Talbot, if Bob's son got his test at, again, CVS or Convenient MD, one of the private providers, the state would still have that information?
Yes. So we keep track of positive results in our residents, right?
I see.
So it should be accessible. Perhaps you can go online to find the number of to call for public
sure.
access.
Yeah.
Okay.
I will, if I can add to that, we would have access, hopefully, to the positive result. We wouldn't necessarily have access to the negative result. So if somebody got tested through, a commercial laboratory and the result is negative and for whatever reason they just don't have their test result back yet, we would not necessarily have that result. That person would have to follow up through the mechanisms that they through the organization that by which they were tested. But the one thing I wanted to add is that we actually have a lot of this data on our data dashboard around test turnaround time.
Right. Yeah.
So people can go to nh.gov/COVID-19 and go to our interactive analytics data dashboard. And there's a testing tab there that will show people the turnaround times that different laboratories are experiencing from, LabCorp to Quest to the public health lab. And they can look at that even in the last 7 days, what those turnaround times have been.
Okay. Well, here's an email from Pedro who says, what kind of discussions are being had about rolling out vaccines to non-native immigrant and refugee communities in New Hampshire? Coincidentally, Pedro says, the immigrant and refugee population in the state are Black and brown folk who are one of the most vulnerable populations. Pedro says, what discussions are being had about robust communication to make sure that information and resources are translated appropriately to keep that population informed, to encourage vaccination? Pedro, it's a great question. And I would ask you, Dr. Talbot, just very broadly, where can people find that information, everybody, and specifically Pedro's question about, you know, populations that might not have access to those channels?
Really, thank you for the question, Pedro. It has been such an important underlying theme for us in terms of allocation of this vaccine, is to make sure that we are recognizing that certain populations have been disproportionately affected, and that does include racial and ethnic minorities. So there is a New Hampshire COVID-19 Equity Response Team that takes this on in all the different intersections, such as appropriate communication, community engagement, and every aspect. So we will be intentionally dedicating a reserve of the vaccine at our next stages of allocation for those who have been disproportionately impacted. So absolutely a very relevant question, and thanks for it.
Yeah, and Pedro, I want to let you know and everybody know that obviously as this story continues to unfold, we here on The Exchange will be looking at these questions about, you know, who's in line for the vaccine and how that's going to play out. For now, Dr. Chan, Dr. Talbot, thank you so much for being with us today. We really appreciate it. We've been talking with Dr. Benjamin Chan, the state's epidemiologist, and Dr. Elizabeth Talbot, the deputy epidemiologist and an infectious disease specialist at Dartmouth. Today's program was produced by Exchange producer Christina Phillips. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.